Welcome to all of you. We really appreciate your coming. I welcome you on behalf of Copyright Clearance Center, our president, Tracy Armstrong, whom a lot of you, I think, know, and the staff of many of the staff of CCC who are here scattered around the room. Miles McNamee, our director of vice president of licensing, Craig Sender, our leader of press relations, Dave Kipp, who is manager of national sales, and several others. And we hope that you will not hesitate to come and talk to us afterwards about what we do, which is we're a broker. We're a licensing organization that help make copyright work. And we're part of the reason that we're here today and invited you here today was to help make copyright work, to introduce some topics that are going to be very interesting today from the panelists about how copyright works. It's a complicated process, but CCC's purpose is to make it easy. Thank you very much, and I'll now introduce you to Bill Sobel. Bill?
Good morning. My name is Bill Sobel. It's an honor to be here. I do events in New York every month, and we kind of do them serious but a little on the tongue-in-cheek side. But since we're in the Capitol, I can't be funny, so I'm going to try not to be funny. Just a couple of quick thanks before we introduce our moderator. We hope he's going to be here, but I do want to acknowledge a very special thanks to my congressman, Steve Israel, from the 2nd District of New York, who was kind enough to make this room available to us for a variety of reasons. He loves his constituents, and I think, and he's also very interested in and very aware of this whole copyright situation and wants to play an active role. So we hopefully will get Steve more involved as things roll on. The folks at the Capitol Visitor Center here in Washington who were incredibly supportive and helpful in getting this room secured for us. Joe Keeley, was Joe here? Joe Keeley, who's been working with us from Pennsylvania Avenue Connections. Chris Kennelly has been a big help. Thank you, Chris. Chris will be doing handling the podcasting, which we'll talk about a little bit later. And my colleague, Lamore Schaffman, without whom I'd be in deep poo-poo. Okay. So thank you to all of you. I have introduced this moderator more times than I'm willing to admit and more times than he wants me to admit. My dear friend Ellis Hennigan, let's see, Ellis is a columnist for Newsday in New York. He's a columnist for AM New York. He's a writer. He's an author. You may occasionally see him on the Fox News Channel giving Bill O'Reilly and the attractive blonde Republicans a hard time. And he's very good at that. And due to my efforts, Ellis has become one of the best event host producer, best host moderators, I think, in New York and hopefully soon in Washington. So it's without further ado, I'd like to introduce the voice of Stormy on the Cartoon Network C-Lab 2021, my dear friend Ellis Hennigan.
Thank you, Bill Sobel. Two quick pieces of advice, Bill. If you want to be serious at the Capitol, do not mention Adult Swim on the Cartoon Network, and do not use terms like, was it doo-doo or poo-poo? It's great to be here. Thank you all so much for coming out. In my time in the media, there have been two phrases that have been deeply disappointing to me. One of them is the phrase, the talent. When I first went from being entirely a print guy to being a TV and talking head guy, for the first time in my life, I was referred to as the talent. And I thought that sounded wonderful. I mean, it was flattering and uplifting, and I realized that my true talents are finally being recognized. And then I realized that expression is always said with a sneer. It's usually there is someone saying, is the talent ready yet? Has the talent finished blow-drying his hair?
Does the talent usually fix his tie?
It's the talent. Thank you, Bill. So in any event, I've been very disappointed by the talent. And the second, and this applies directly to this room, I think, is the term intellectual property. I when I first heard that, and it came very early in my career as a newspaper guy, when somebody plagiarized something I wrote, and I didn't really care, but someone explained to me that this was intellectual property, and I really needed to be concerned about this, and it had value, and maybe we should charge them, or we should sue them, or something. And I loved the way it sounded, that I had been a creator of intellectual property. It sounded so flattering, and I finally believed that my level of intelligence was being recognized across the newsroom. And then I discovered that I wasn't the only one producing intellectual property, but that Donald Duck was, and that cartoon characters were, and Howard Stern was, and it dragged myself way down. I felt deeply deflated. And then I heard how much Stern was making off of his intellectual property, and then I decided it was okay after all. In any event, it's a great treat to be with you guys. We have a terrific panel today. Anyone who cares at all about the issue of copyright ought to want to hear every word out of these four men's mouths, because they truly, representing four different aspects of this larger issue, are all terrific. Shall we bring the panel in? Have everybody sit down and row. Come on in, guys, and I'll interrogate you one at a time. We're going to make a lot of time today for questions at the end. I'll try to keep things rolling. Sit so we can sit where you like. We didn't really get to assign seating, did we? And I'll interrogate each of them. Hopefully we'll do some back and forth, having the differing perspectives on this issue collide with each other. And as I say, think of questions. We'll make time for them at the end. We thankfully have an audience here that is knowledgeable on the subject, engaged in all of these issues, and from what I can tell from the coffee chat before, not especially shy. So I'm hoping that you all will take advantage of this gathering here today. Tim Shea is responsible at Next New Networks for producing, I believe, more original video programming on the internet, something like television, but that shows up on the internet. He and his crew at Next New Networks probably producing more of it than anybody. Certainly, more high quality versions of it. The viewership numbers are expanding hugely. The quality of the programming is shockingly good for how little some people are paid to make it. And day after day after day, Tim and his colleagues are dealing in a guerrilla sort of a way with the very issues that are on the cutting edge of technology and the law colliding around the issue of copyright. Tim, let me start with you, and we're going to go through the panel one at a time, but let me start with you and have you describe to the room, if you will, in a very practical way, two or three of the challenges that you guys face as this video programming comes in. You decide who needs to be paid, who needs to be licensed, what can be mashed together, and what can simply be put out into the world.
Sure. Everybody here? All right. Yeah, definitely. Hi. So at Next New Networks, we put out, like you said, a pretty huge amount of content. And we put out, I think it's something like 40 hours worth of content, original content a month. And like you said, people are not always paid very much. There are several creators who work with us that are making very good livings right now. But there's some people who are just starting out that they're making effectively no money for the content they're putting out. And they're doing it to build audiences online and eventually make money. And like you said, there's huge audiences watching this too. We live in the world of, we put out a lot of our content in places like YouTube and iTunes. You guys probably heard that there's something like 2 billion streams a day on YouTube, people watching short form, mostly content. In our particular case, we make up a nice little percentage of that. We do about 150 million video views a month of our content, which means on any given day, somewhere near 4 million views. 4 or 5 million in some cases. So, a lot of people watching. In terms of uniques, that's maybe, because that's a media term, like there's about 50 million unique viewers watching our content every month. So, big audiences. There's money now being made too. We put advertising across all our content, and we share that with the creators and producers of the content. And so a couple of the challenges that we run into on the copyright side is, for one thing, from day one, we realized that unlike other companies that we might be lumped into, people think of us and they go, oh, you're kind of like Blip TV or you're kind of like YouTube. Well, YouTube and Blip are platforms. And so they're covered by the DMCA and Fair Harbor, which, if anybody's familiar with those terms, that allows you to allow users of your platform, if they infringe, you know, by putting up content that's copyrighted, you can basically say, hey, we didn't know they were doing it, and you can take it down and everything's okay. As we're actually a publisher of content in the space, so we are actively putting content out into the world, and we're saying that we've reviewed the content. So we've never been covered by those rules. So from day one, we've had to spend a lot of money. It's one of the reasons we had to raise so much money to do the company, is we've spent a lot of money thinking about copyright, thinking about clearances, making sure that we're in the right, and trying to keep up with the space. The other big challenge is that it seems like to me, from practically working with it every day, that a lot of the copyright rules and laws in the marketplace, they can't really keep up with the pace of technological innovation. That's everything from, you know, the fact that there's platforms like YouTube that make it so incredibly easy to share copyrighted content. And most people are doing it in pure ignorance and not for commercial reasons. You know, most people are just, they saw something awesome on TV and they want to share it with their friends. And it's really hard to litigate that or to control that. The other thing is that you know, people are just naturally inclined to be creative with content. Content is so fungible now. It's so plastic. It's so easy. You know, it used to be hard to try to figure out how to pull something off TV, but with an HD camera and an iPhone, you can hold your iPhone up to a TV, record it, and it can be up on YouTube in minutes. Even more, most people on their phones, not most people, but it's very easy now to download for $1 or $2 video editing software to your phone. So you actually start creating a mashup with that content almost instantaneously.
Tim Shea, let me stop you. When someone comes in and some kid, some smart kid, brings you a beautiful piece of video that he's taken pieces from 7 other things that people have made and says, this is brilliant, you think it's terrific, are you making him pay somebody for that?
Well, yeah. So, you know, for most cases, we have to just basically turn it down. You know, unless they're making enough money that they can go out and clear everything. In most cases, we almost never have to pay people to use copyrighted content. Usually, we get permission. You know, people realize they're not making much money. They realize it's promotional. There's lots of different reasons, but you know, we can usually go out and clear most of the content we want to use. But you know, there's a great example. There's a show that's a very, very big hit for us called Autotune the News. Some people might have seen it. They take news clips and mash it up in a really creative way. They are flying wildly outside the mainstream in terms of what you can do. But what's happened is they've been completely embraced by all the media that they're remixing. Katie Couric has had them on their show, The Today Show. So we've basically been given blanket permission by all the people that they're working with.
Well, let's see how they respond when you start treating people really badly on that show. And I want to get back to that
that's a good point.
In more confrontational situations. But I want to bring Jason Williams in. Jason, you work in what some people would consider the old media as well as the new media as an Emmy Award-winning producer of all kind of shows, including the very cool Submarine Sharks of Steel. You've made things across a whole bunch of platforms, historical stuff and current affairs things and biographical programming for the Discovery Channel and National Geographic and TLC and BBC. And you bring some British sophistication to this gathering here today. Now, how do you deal with those issues as someone who is what is a more sort of more out of the traditional model of a content producer in these fields? Are you making deals with people? Are you just grabbing stuff and using it? What are the kind of challenges that you guys are facing now?
Well, I'm definitely the old school guy. And the world of long form is really, particularly in its sort of, you know, classic incarnation of network and cable delivery, is subjected to extraordinarily strict regulations internally set up in, obviously, in reaction to, you know, the realities of copyright law by the networks. And you know, I would say, if I'm looking at a budget, you know, we'll pull a number out of the air, you know, call it $300,000 for an hour of primetime discovery program, $300,000-$400,000. There's probably about 10% of that at this juncture, which is being offset to take care of some aspect of copyright law and the requirements to be able to, put programming in front of the networks, which they'll accept. One of the sort of, the dirty secrets of TV, of course, is that most shows aren't hits. Most TV is out there doing, as one wag once said, stopping the commercials bumping into each other. the fact is, if you deliver an hour of TV and it's not plug and play, the network's really not going to be very happy about it. They're in the business of taking programming and getting it on air in as straightforward a fashion as possible. They really don't want to litigate fair use issues. What they really want is, the next edition of Cupcakes, War or whatever it is, and they want it, quick, fast, and on air. And what that does is, it places an enormous amount of pressure on producers to make sure that even if, I'm operating at a sort of fairly high, an elevated level of program providing, I'm subjected to exactly the same strictures. Nobody is going to want to litigate my little bit of art, thank you very much. It's at the level of the legal affairs, a film about Muslims who saved Jews during the Second World War, that's a plug, we're about to launch that show, is going to be looked at exactly in the same way as Cupcake Wars. And it's tough. And my biggest disappointment, by the way, is I was hoping that I was going to have a really good fun time ribbing Tim, because, I look at, these sort of the kids on the internet, and I'm like, oh, God, they get anything on the air, They're not having to, pay these, vast amounts of legal supervision fees, which we have to do. And it turns out, of course, actually he does. I was so disappointed. I came in here, I'd like written stuff, I'll get him,
Now, Jason, does that entire legal process, those fees, the lawyers who are looking, does that impede your creativity, you making worse work because of that?
I don't know if it's worse work, but let's just say that it imposes a grammar on the creative process which honestly looks pretty antediluvian when I see the open grammar which is able to be achieved creatively in other distribution areas, particularly in the world of short form, particularly on internet distributed areas. I mean, I actually don't begrudge, what's taking place on other delivery platforms at all. I think it's great. There's an extraordinary creative buzz out there. I mean, the great risk, I think, is rather of seeing that creativity extinguished by an overzealous application of copyright law. There is right now an extraordinary amount of self-censoring which takes place. There's only so many beatdowns you need from a legal affairs department of one of the major networks before you just don't go there again. It's like, why am I going to do this? We recently, I don't know, can I share this? We recently did a show called Hitler's Mummies. All right, it's a good show. And
the mummies decided to sue.
Well, they didn't have agents, but but kind of they did. And then they actually there was the individual involved in getting very close to litigation while this on this. I'll give you a quick. Here's for the lawyers in the room. You're going to love this. So this guy. He made his first $1 million by doing PPV, pay-per-view fights in the Boston area, right? And he'd get these, young Irish kids, and they'd be ready to go to battle with each other, and he'd have the posters around town, and the PPV rights were out there. Everybody knew you could get them. And all the bars in South Boston, all right, they're, of course, they've got it. They've got that fight night, right? What he did was he sent all of his guys around with cameras to all of the bars which were playing his fights, which hadn't licensed the pay-per-view rights, and then threatened them with massive lawsuits and got them to just capitulate and give him his money. So that's how he made his first money. It's, it's, I thought, kind of neat.
That qualifies as genius in this environment.
I thought it was a kind of wonderfully perverse genius. And when this guy, because you can imagine, he's sort of, if you're willing to do that in South Boston, you imagine what he's going to do, some smiley little faced Brit like me. And when he basically came in to represent the mummies, there was some possibility I might be defaming them. I choked.
And paid money immediately to the... did you buy off the mummies?
Well, yeah, let's just say that the editorial shifted. So.
There's some very rich mummies. Stan McCoy has clearly the coolest title in the room. As Assistant U.S. Trade Rep for Intellectual Property and Innovation. How did you get them to add the innovation to the title, I wonder?
You know, it just sounds sexy.
It makes you... It gives you cred in the new media world, I think.
When you work for the government, it's in lieu of pay.
I see. But now you have spent many years involved in the enforcement side of this.
Sure.
And now still have enforcement responsibilities, but a broader view about where the law and government's role should be heading as technology and intellectual property collide with each other. Do you arrive with solutions for these things? We have a long legal history. We have lots of legislation, but we have a very, very fast-changing world. What is it reasonable for us to expect government to do?
No, I mean, in some ways, honestly, government is trying to keep up and adapt the system. I mean, it was about 35 years ago. It was one of the titans of copyright law in the United States. So a woman named Barbara Ringer, who passed away last year, said that the rights of authors, the human rights of authors, were being sacrificed more and more on the altar of technological innovation. I think she was talking about the Xerox machine. I mean, she was talking about photocopying, and it hasn't gotten better in the last 35 years, but it's because people like that have created a durable, sort of technology-neutral copyright system that we still have copyright, and it's still viable, even in the face of some of these challenges. And it's from where I sit in the trade world incredibly important that U.S. creators are able to get revenue from overseas markets. If you think about a place like China, there's a lot of money floating around in that marketplace. Not a lot of it is flowing in to the creators of creative content that's appearing on Chinese websites or on Chinese television or that's being purchased in the Chinese marketplace. So I'll give you an example. Until last year, there was no official rate set in China to compensate songwriters and other music right holders who have their music played on Chinese state television. Now, the Chinese government has a lot of money. They can pay a little of it to, you know, American songwriters whose music gets played on Chinese state television. Well, after we complained about this for a number of years, they finally did set a rate. Now, it's the lowest rate in the world, and we're working on them to get it a little bit better. But it's this kind of work that we do in the government. It's just trying to create this infrastructure of respect for copyright that allows performers and producers and creative people to be compensated for their work, not just in the U.S., but in markets around the world.
But now, do you come in the morning sometime after a long day of work the day before, finding some solution to some highly complex technological and legal question, and then the technology is just raced so far ahead, you wondered why you spent all your time doing that?
Yeah, you know, we have the DMCA example that Tim raised is a good one, because we've worked and worked and worked to get that notice and takedown scheme in a lot of our U.S. trade agreements and get people putting that in place. And here the technology has evolved in a way that, okay, notice and takedown is still really relevant to one kind of problem, mm-hmm. but there's a whole other kind of problem out there that notice and takedown is a lot less relevant to. So, yeah, we do live in that universe where the problems outpace the solutions, and we have to play a bit of catch-up.
All right. As we go along today, I want to pin you down later about some of the solutions to these things and what the next three or five schemes that you're hatching are. But first, though, I do want to bring in John Baumgarten. Everywhere John goes, people tell him he is the leading copyright attorney in America. So if he seems confident, maybe that's the reason why. It's great to have you here today. You have been involved in this issue for a long, long time. There are very few cases that don't in some way or another have your fingerprints on them. Texaco involving photocopying and the Kinko's case of unauthorized course packs. I remember getting some of those in college and on and on and on. I want to, John, use you in two ways in this panel today. One is as the legal mind at the table, but also the person with, I think, the longest historical perspective on these issues. As you hear people wring their hands about the pace of technology and its effect on the law, do you sometimes think, been there, done that, been through these panics before, everybody just chill out a little bit?
Yes. Not entirely. First of all, I'm a little intimidated because you mentioned that talent sobriquet, and the first thing you and I said to each other in the back of the room, and we had a discussion, and I think I referred to the extent to which I work with, quote, talent, close quote, as opposed to others. So I'm not sure how that washes out. But I'm glad Stan mentioned photocopying, because I didn't want to be the first person to mention it. Because when I do in discussions of today's technology, I mean, half the people don't know what it is. Half the people eyes glaze over. And the third half, they just leave the room. But I think it's an important point. Yeah, I and others in this room, I mean, if you think you're old school, I'm old school, old school. And there are some others here who've been around as long.
Thanks, John.
You're welcome. You're welcome, Prince. I look directly at you. As the Motion Picture Association representative. But Keith's just a baby, so we let him out. There have been technology battles for as long as copyrights it's been around. And to a lot of extent, to a great extent, you know, the creators, publishers, producers, and the system has changed. I've just spent a lot of time dealing with library copying, for example, and litigation and Kinko's. But the educational establishment in this country hasn't, you know, gone under because they had to comply with copyright rules. And sometimes I do think that that the reaction is one of hysteria and usually a rush to embrace the technology and sacrifice other values. And the discussions always tend to be, how can we subtract from copyright in order to embrace the new technology? And the rush is to let the technology do everything it's capable of doing, no matter what stands in the way of that. But I think historically, if you look at things, there are adjustments that can be made on both sides. And maybe later today, when we talk about alternative solutions, I can throw out some solutions to copyright and technology today that involve, you know, improving the situation for copyright owners and not just rejecting it. And the fact that we're here with Copyright Clearance Center, I think, is a typical example. They came into being to make copyright work in the midst of a technological revolution. So there are immediate solutions that lack some of this urgency. I think people also have to have patience. I mean, businesses with millions of dollars of investments, whether it's the record industry or the motion picture industry or the software industry or the publishing industry, they're not going to change their business yet tomorrow just because some new technology came out. But they will eventually mature and things will work out.
John Bumpkin, if we have the assumption here that the technology is racing first and the law is rushing to catch up, need it be that way? Are there ways that we can come up with legal solutions that actually can help steer the technology in effect?
If the solutions have to come from Congress, it's going to take a long time. If the solutions have to come from business, my view is they'll come, but it won't happen overnight. Part of my career, I and my colleagues have been successful in using another instrument for adaptation, and that's the courts. And frankly, I'm much more comfortable with the courts than I am in Congress. The courts, yeah, sometimes they get it right, sometimes they get it wrong, but you get the decision on the merits with the facts, and people adjust their ways of behavior to it. And whether it's Texaco or Kinko's or Jurisline or any other cases that I or other cases that other people have handled, things work out. There's going to be, you know, what happens in the Viacom and football league cases against YouTube and Google is going to be important. It's not over yet. There was a decision in the district court. There are two appeals pending. So, you know, it's going to take time because court decisions take a long time. So that's where I go back to patience. Things just won't change to adopt technology overnight, and I don't think they should. Now, if I could just take one more minute, one thing that I don't have an answer to and I've been scratching my head is I don't think technology is a new problem with respect to copyright. But I have to concede that this technology, digital technology, I think has ramifications and threats and benefits that go beyond those that we've seen before. Now, where that leads me, I really don't know yet. But I think it is different, and I think it's about time, that, at least in my mind, that I acknowledge that. But I think you still go back to the principles that some of the solutions can be solutions that enhance the workings of the copyright system and not just enhance the abilities of the users to make uncompensated use. And again, maybe later we could talk about that.
Tim and Jason, you and the creative people you work with are not waiting around for the courts, for Congress, for business. I mean, you all are doing this work, and smart people are coming in and dreaming up new ways to mash things together that take work that others have done and exploit it in fresh new ways, and then we debate about who, if anyone, should be compensated. Can you imagine a situation where there's more order to this, or is that just the way it's going to go?
Well,
it's working.
You know, I actually think, and I believe, you know, in talking with Tim, actually, there is a considerable amount of order there. And, I mean, particularly for what Tim's doing and for, you know, in the world of, you know, cable and broadcast TV, as I say, I mean, you know, there is so much order that actually it affects creative decisions even before you sort of, you know, you roll a camera. You know that you're not going to roll a camera in a place where you're not going to be able to secure the rights and permits to be able to shoot in that location and use that material in perpetuity in all and any media and distribution never conceived of now. And I mean, you've seen the language on some of these agreements. You're being requested by these organizations, these media groups, to supply them with very, very broad legal remits to be able to use this material in any and all ways imaginable. And if you can't actually guarantee that proviso to the network, you ain't shooting in that place. So actually, I think there's been a very substantial corralling. Where, you know, that corralling isn't happening is in these areas where, you know, safe harbor provisions are in place and where the sort of the real mashing up. I think, you know, from my perspective, one of the most interesting areas in all of this is what's going to happen to media which is actually passed out of copyright. There's an extraordinary moment in the culture is upon us now, which is this sort of confluence of Google's having digitized, you know, I don't know how many tens of millions of volumes at this point, most of which have already passed out of copyright, pre-1917, whatever the day is right now, but which can now be meshed into completely new forms of reading. You know, if I got my hands on Charles Darwin and what I could do in terms of turning a great Charles Darwin manuscript into a completely new form of interactive readership in the context of an ebook today, would, I think, totally redefine the nature of that work, but actually, and define it for generations to come, but it's actually out of copyright. So are we suddenly in a position where, in a sense, by sheer technological heft, Google is sort of going to be re-copyrighting, you know, hundreds of thousands of out-of-copyright authors' works. I just throw that out there. Something like that is taking place. And it's a sort of, you know, you could look at it as a sort of massive corporate rape of the culture. You know, because one definition of all of those works which are passed out of copyright may suddenly about to, you know, hit your e-screen for the next couple of generations. Anyway, that's just food for thought.
I think one thing that's really interesting is, you know, where people start using some of the same technological solutions to try to get around the problem. You know, there's a lot of chaos out there. We as a company just decided to embrace it. You know, I'd say the two things that we've embraced the most that have been really interesting for us, and they're not perfect by any means, but one is just the new copyright definition of the Creative Commons. And whenever possible, we put a lot of our content out via Creative Commons copyright. We use a very specific one, which is a version of the Creative Commons copyright called the non-commercial share alike license, which says that we're basically giving anyone who sees our content blanket permission to take it and use it in non-commercial ways. And by use it, we mean create new works with it, create derivative works with it. But we're also saying that if they do it, they have to use the same copyright. They have to also share alike. That's really interesting, because what that's allowed us to do is it's allowed us to give basic blanket permission to people to sort of take it and do things with it as long as they don't make money off it. It still needs to be enforced, which means that we occasionally see people take our content and start making money off it, and then we say, hey, wait a minute, you need our permission. So the way that the technology allows us to do that is that, you know, we use a lot of the same tools that people are using to infringe to actually find infringement. So, for instance, I subscribe to Google Alerts for just about every copyrighted term that we have. Everything that's a trademark of our company. And when I see, you know, I get an alert pretty quickly from Google every time somebody uploads one of our videos to someplace that I've never heard of. I can look at it and go, well, these guys clearly aren't abiding by our copyright. Let's send them a letter. So we do that. We also use a thing that's very interesting that YouTube created, partly out of all these, you know, conflicts they had with Viacom and the like, is they create a program called the Content ID System, and this allows people who are official partners of YouTube to basically digitally fingerprint their content by uploading it. So every time we upload one of our videos to YouTube, we're basically also doing a digital fingerprint of the video and audio tracks. And anytime anybody else uploads something to YouTube that matches it, we get a little alert. And we can basically choose what we want to do then. We can choose to, you know, send them a little note telling them to take it down, or we can choose to just claim it. And by claiming it, that means that we're saying this is something that is derivative of our content, and we want to be able to put our advertising on it. And those people get a letter. They can contest it. There's this whole system where they say, no, our work is transformative, da-da-da-da. We're using it under fair use. You can't put your ads on here. But there's a whole – so YouTube's actually tried to build a technological solution that allows us all just to find each other and give each other permission or duke it out if we've got to duke it out. And it happens to us all the time, too. We get – you know, we'll have something that somehow – you know, the technology isn't perfect, so sometimes we'll get a note from Viacom saying that we use some of their content, and we're like, no, look, the two video – we didn't use any of your content, and sometimes we have to scramble around to do that. But the technology is allowing us to actually at least every time we've had a major dispute with another copyright holder, luckily we've been able to track the person down and work it out. It is a nightmare scenario for us that things like DMCA could cause us to like take down and lose money and lose business, but it's part of the cost of doing business to figure those things out.
Now, Stan McCoy, both Tim and Jason sound very responsible and thoughtful about this. I mean, they're not just grabbing stuff willy-nilly, but there does have to be an enforcement part of this, right? Because we have to assume not everybody is being quite as thoughtful as these two guys. Can we expect the government to do that? Who's going to do that?
Yeah, no, it's absolutely true. And in fact, you know, people who are taking a responsible approach to these issues and trying to figure out how to work within the law and work with the strengths and the shortcomings of the law are all very much undermined by the existence of black markets out there, whether you're talking about physical markets or digital markets, where the rules don't apply, and while those markets may be great from some perspectives, they're not great from a rule of law perspective, and from creating an environment where creators can be compensated and make a living out of doing creative work, it's not great, and the real challenge that we face internationally now is how do we work with other governments to approach cooperatively this problem of the notorious marketplaces that are out there on the internet and get a handle on some of this illegal activity. And you've seen enforcement activity by the U.S. government, by governments around the world trying to do exactly that.
Mm-hmm. As you think of these, the international challenges versus the domestic challenges, what do you spend most of your time worrying about?
You know, I tend to worry about three things. One is political will, one is economic development, and the third is rule of law. And it's those, to me, are the big ingredients in getting respect for intellectual property and copyright in particular to put down roots in foreign markets. Without political will, without a sense on the part of the government that providing an atmosphere of protection is something that they want to do, you won't have any progress. Without a sense of economic development that there's something in it for them, you won't have respect for property rights. And without rule of law, you won't have respect for property rights.
John Baumgarten, hanging over this entire conversation is a very mushy term called fair use. And I guess you probably know what it means, but I don't know if anybody else knows what it means. Can we do better than that? Should we get more specific?
Yeah, I know what it means, but it costs you to find out. So I'm not telling. fair use, years ago, a guy who was even more old school than I am, I think his name was Joe McDonald, a motion picture industry lawyer, I believe, defined fair use as, you know, take no more from others than you would have them take from you, which is not a bad approach. Fair use is always, frankly, a bit of a conundrum because in many ways it is, you know, critical to our copyright system. It loosens it up. It allows things to happen that a strict application of the copyright laws wouldn't allow to happen. And it's elastic and it's adaptable. And, you know, Congress, when they wrote the fair use provisions of the Act of 1976, it had been case law before then, they weren't thinking of most of the disputes that have surrounded fair use in the last decade. I don't think they were thinking of the Betamax case. But the doctrine, whether applied properly or improperly in any particular case, is elastic enough to cover it. So that's the – and what foreign countries try to do is, if they don't have fair use, and a lot of them have it under different names, they try to come up with specific examples of what's permitted and what's not. So if you tried to adapt that today, you'd have a statute, you know, that's 14 volumes long just on the fair use section, and nobody would understand it anyway because it would be worse than the tax code. But then the other side of the coin of fair use is it is complex and a little bit hard to apply to concrete situations. I can tell you, most copyright lawyers, if they're honest with you, will tell you the one question they hate getting from clients is this fair use? It's a very uncomfortable question from copyright lawyers because the answer is the answer that most clients hate to hear, and that is it's not really certain. Let me write you a 35-page memorandum on the four factors of fair use, and the last sentence of the memorandum is we're not sure how this is going to be applied in this particular. And I admit that is a problem. It's a problem for these gentlemen and other creative types. But again, major industries have thrived in this country for generations, relying and inculcating what fair use probably means. I think most book publishers, they know that they can quote a reasonable amount, and they don't worry very much about it. The notion that the copyright community has been anti-fair use is nonsense, and the notion that publishers of biographies and histories, for example, whether video or print, don't rely on fair use is silly. Of course they rely on it. The studios rely on fair use. So I don't have a precise answer other than to say that it tends to work itself out, and some guidance emerges from courts and from reasonable people. There's some things that just cross the line and most people would think are not fair use. And yet businesses go ahead and do them with impunity because under today's technology they can. There are other systems that make it less important to know what fair use is. Again, pitch the Copyright Clearance Center. You take a blank or a similar license from the Copyright Clearance Center and you pay a certain amount and you really don't have to worry much about how much of that is fair use, how much of it should I be licensing because you're safe. So there are business solutions. So I guess the bottom line is, you know, what alternative is there? A statutory listing of everything conceivable that might be permissible without permission? Or the existing fair use doctrine, because I don't see any other alternative other than working things out as things have worked out over years. It might be a little bit uncomfortable for you the first time, the second time, but it seems to me the lesson
that discussion daily, that uncomfortable discussion daily.
But the lesson we're learning from your comments and from yours is that the system's working. It's not falling apart, whether it's new technology or old technology. Fascinating stuff is getting produced. People are enjoying it, and it's working. It's not the copyright system requirement to get permission, requirement to clear rights. You know, it's not made everything come to a crashing halt.
Yeah, I mean, I think the challenge, if I can just
jump in for
a second, I think the challenge for us now as producers is, you know, I mean, it's always been a hard business to create content. You know, it's always been actually a very stupid way to make a living because, you know, most people that make content don't succeed. But now, as a producer or a publisher of content, any kind of content, you're increasingly competing with every other piece of content that's ever been made and multiple copies of it. You know, like people can choose to watch or read or listen to your thing, or they can choose to watch or read or listen. And I guess the challenge for all of us, I mean, that just makes it that much more Darwinian and fiercely competitive. But it also means that, you know, the coming challenge for all of us as more and more people come online and more people have access to the tools of creation and duplication, right, is that, you know, the internet is also it's an anonymizing force and it's an internationalizing force like you've been pointing out. And so if somebody is making something, it creates this, you know, it's going to be this really interesting situation because there's all of us that are trying to comply and there's an army of people that are basically creating content and taking away eyeballs from you that don't have. So I guess the big challenge for all of us to figure out is what do you do with all the people that they're not companies, they're not corporations, what is the definition of fair use in the world of just people who are fans and consumers that are creating and publishing? And that's I think that's the real challenge for us coming up because I don't think companies have the resources or the wherewithal to litigate this, but it's it does eat away in a way at your, you know, you wonder how much, you know, more profitable your business can be. My company isn't profitable yet, and you wonder how much more profitable we could be if there was less competition from our fans. You know, that's a weird situation to be in. It's a really, really weird situation. And we've just chosen to embrace it, and I think it's made us bigger. I do have some very definable metrics that show that we make an extra 10% of revenue in many given months by embracing and putting ads on the people that are copying our content. But, you know, you always wonder what else is out there.
Yeah. Now, at the risk of being the third person today to say Darwin, there is a certain natural selection to the room today, which is that there are a lot of people in here who are engaged in this issue in a whole bunch of different ways. So I promise to open for questions. Why don't we do that now, and then I'll circle back at the very end with my final question. You guys can be thinking about this. Is one thing that we could do to make this process better, just a single thing that would either, from a governmental point of view, a creative point of view or a legal point of view, make it better. But you can reflect on that a moment. Who in the room would like to join the conversation? Yes, why don't you start?
I'll try a question.
Thank you.
You were talking about Creative Commons and the use in commercial and non-commercial use. And at CCC, we are constantly asked that question, at least the lawyers among us. And a way I'd like to ask you is, when Pfizer, which is probably the largest contributor of cost-free drugs in the world, does something for the benefit of mankind versus, well, around here, when George Washington University, a charitable institution, sells services, which of those is commercial and which of those is non-commercial, and how do you do that with Creative – what does Creative Commons help you to do with that?
Yeah, I don't know. That is actually, that sounds above my pay grade, actually, to answer. I have no idea. Maybe I don't know. Maybe John knows something about that.
I'm not sure of that. I guess lawyers in the room would have to look at the Creative Commons license and see how it defines commercial use. I mean, but my reaction to Creative Commons is, you know, great. It's a perfect example of why the copyright system works. Creative Commons is based on copyright. You do what's permitted, and if you don't do what's permitted, you're in violation of the terms of license and copyright laws. And in fact, Creative Commons has used the conventional copyright law to enforce adherence to the terms of its license. So although Creative Commons is sometimes dismissed as a tool of the copyleft movement, it's really a great approach of traditional copyright laws. If you sign up for, if you license through Creative Commons, you're choosing to make yourself available with permission as long as it's used for non-commercial purposes, whatever that means. If they use it for commercial purposes, they're a violation of the license. Now, another copyright owner licenses and says, if you want to use it for commercial purposes, you use Xbox. So I think Creative Commons is an innovative and welcome solution to the way a lot of people want to do business, and questions about how to interpret the particular term of a particular license, you have to look at the license agreement.
But yeah, they probably have defined commercial use in there somewhere. And,
well, Fred would know. He wouldn't have asked the question if he knew.
They actually have it.
Interesting.
The reason I asked the question is you're using the Creative Commons license. As John says, it's a tool mm-hmm. for creators to license yeah. their materials. And that's a word that I get. We license a lot of organizations in the private sector who acknowledge that they're commercial entities. But they endlessly ask us the question, well, gee, I saw Creative Commons license on this. I'm only going to use it like this.
Yeah.
And only, you know, as the introduction to only with my mother, only on Sunday, you know, right. all that. But I'm a for-profit institution. Can I be non-commercial? And I was wondering what who uses it thinks about what they're issuing in the way of a license.
Yeah, well, that is interesting because we basically then get to subjectively choose what we're gonna consider commercial. You know, it's funny because I think a lot of us that use the Creative Commons, we're using it. You know, we're using it as almost like a, you know, we're almost using it as like a little sign to say there's a lot of people that look for Creative Commons licensed content to get started and get creative. So it's a way of saying, hey, it's okay to use our stuff. And in some ways, it's a way to market and promote our own content and get it out there. You know, we as a company chose, you know, to just embrace this kind of mashup culture to get ourselves and our brands bigger. And so far, it's worked. You know, do you at some point transition and become a company like Viacom where it becomes very important to get every penny out? And I understand exactly why that's important to them. You know, and hopefully I'm out of the company by then, you know, in my own life.
Who else cares?
I'm very curious what the panel has to say about the C-32 bill up in Canada. Our neighbors to the north have a very interesting view about fair use, or at least pending, and I'd be curious to, particularly from our government's perspective, you know, what is the opinion there, and what are we doing about this?
Yeah, I think the copyright reform in Canada is something that's been a priority for the U.S. government for a long time, and it's frankly been a priority for successive Canadian governments for a long time, and we're happy to see this Canadian government moving forward with copyright reform that they feel is in their interest. Now, in terms of the particular package that's out there now, I think it's got it's got a number of strong points to it. The important thing for us is that Canada fully implements the WIPO internet treaties that they signed more than a decade ago and haven't yet implemented into Canadian law. And many of you know that that's caused legal problems in the Canadian courts, and it's caused Canada to be a haven market, frankly, for some disreputable websites that are engaged in some of the problems. problem activities that these folks are all contending with. So the U.S. government is four square behind moving forward with copyright reform in Canada. We have been for a long time. Our Special 301 reports echoed that for a long time. Now, we're aware of the concerns about certain, you know, exceptions that are reflected in the Canadian law and different groups who are talking about what the scope of exceptions should be. That's a healthy debate to have. It's the kind of debate we would have in the U.S. if we were talking about legislation. I don't think it's going to be helpful for me as the U.S. government to jump into that debate right now. I mean, it's a good discussion for Canada to be having on Canada's terms, and we want to be back here encouraging Canada to move forward with a larger project of copyright reform that's been so long awaited and so overdue.
Actually, I have a...
Oh, go ahead.
Do you mind if I have a question? This regards WikiLeaks, but I want to look at it not from a political and diplomatic perspective, but really from a copyright perspective. So I'm curious, those documents that are most recently released from the U.S. government, are they in fact copyright protected? Or not? Are they open source for some reason? Two, who could sue and who could against on what cause? So could the U.S. government sue WikiLeaks, or the foreign countries, or the diplomats of the foreign countries sue WikiLeaks? But also, can the foreign countries sue the United States? So I'm just sort of curious, from an exploration purely on a copyright basis, what are the ramifications of WikiLeaks?
That's a really cool question. And somebody in law school is going to be writing about it, I guess, someday. The easy part is that publications of the U.S. government are not protected by copyright in the U.S.
But, John, is a confidential cable a publication?
I was asked about copyright, not confidentiality. And the word publication in that sense substitute the word work. So whether it's a published work or an unpublished work doesn't matter. But works of the U.S. government are not protected by copyright in this country. There's an exception for standard reference data in the Department of Commerce. There's an exception for postage stamps, but that's because the Postal Service isn't considered the U.S. government for the copyright purposes. But that's the simple answer. But then you start getting to some intriguing questions. There's long been an open question about to what extent are works of the U.S. government protected in foreign countries under their own copyright laws, and it's largely an unanswered question. On the other hand, the works of foreign governments, with some exceptions, are protected by copyright in the U.S. So if you really try to get into this, it does pose some interesting questions, but I think there are some more fundamental issues being discussed. I was listening to the radio coming in, and that people are talking about cyber war now based upon the arrest of Mr. Assange. So, the only simple answer I can give you is the works of the U.S. government are not protected by copyright in the United States. So even if you wanted to approach the cable disclosure in the U.S. court on a copyright infringement basis with the U.S. government as a plaintiff, it wouldn't work.
Staying on the... it's interesting to me there's a lot of questions on international, so staying on that front, are there any copyright systems throughout the rest of the world that perhaps we can take something from or learn from?
I know there are some draconian penalties, including if we had time to sit down and think and analyze it, there are probably attractive from my perspective. For example, I think some countries don't have the degree of internet service provider liability immunity that at least some people think service providers have in this country. I don't completely agree with the description that was given earlier. I think service providers have to do more than simply respond to a takedown notice if they're otherwise aware of the infringing activity. I'm sure that those who think differently than I do, who would like to free up copyright a bit, see attractive positions in the copyright laws of other countries, which they feel are more lenient. But, you know, it's a tough question because my generation of copyright lawyer, particularly with my time in the government, you know, we had the Holy Grail, and the Grail was to deformalize copyright, get rid of copyright, know this, get rid of these other artificial requirements. And yet now you see that the proponents of more liberal copyright law, in order to throw more stuff into the public domain, want to reinvigorate formality. So what's a good copyright idea? What's a bad copyright law? It tends to change drastically with this perspective of anyone, and they would give you different answers to that question. But yeah, I think, I don't know if Stan has some examples, but there are undoubtedly provisions in foreign copyright laws that are attractive.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question to ask sitting here on Capitol Hill. It's largely a question for our Congress, right? We don't write the copyright law in the administration. Congress writes it here, and they're the ones who would, you know, they're the ones who would be the first and foremost to learn and take those lessons. It's one of the things that we wrestled with in working on the anti-counterfeiting trade agreement, because we wanted to get together with a bunch of like-minded governments who all want to have that kind of conversation about how we do copyright protection in this era. None of them wanted to use the vehicle of an international agreement to work any radical changes in their laws, and we certainly haven't done that from the U.S. perspective, but we have created a cooperative mechanism where we can share and learn from these other governments about how we can approach what are in reality, you know, very much transborder problems, and we've got to have that kind of cooperative structure in place going forward. And on the subject of ACTA, I can also say that, you know, because of ACTA, USTR was a WikiLeaks victim before being a WikiLeaks victim was cool. So we know what that's all about.
This side has been woefully quiet, I have noticed.
Uncharacteristically
quiet. Okay.
From the creator's point of view, as creators of content, do you see a way in which the unbelievably diffuse world of creators is ever going to get sufficiently well organized, even informally, to allow copyright to work on a basis that users would find attractive? I mean, I'll be honest, I'm speaking from Copyright Clearance Center's point of view in part by saying what we've managed to do is to create a market between rights holders and users so that copyright can flow and can work. But one of the ways that we succeed in doing that is because, especially on the rights holding side, rights holders have fortunately organized themselves into corporations. And so there are fewer of them, relatively speaking, than there are creators of content. And one of the frustrations I know, for example, in the photography industry, which has been facing this and up here on Capitol Hill is trying to get Congress to help them, is if everybody is alone, it's very hard to manage copyright in a way that users who want to use lots and lots of stuff find attractive. Is there any movement, do you think, among creators to figure something out like that?
Yeah, as a sort of, you know, token independent producer, in this country, no. I don't see any indication of that at all. It's very, very diffuse, and, you know, the sort of perceived sort of, you know, resistance to any attempt to sort of aggregate a trade body out of the independent production sector is just... it's enough to, like, choke it off. There's been various very timid efforts on both West and East Coast, but I just don't see it happening. In the UK, which I have some passing familiarity, despite the, you know, strange accent, I've actually been living here for 30 years, so my knowledge of the UK market is fairly limited, but there they do have a very active independent producers association, which has actually managed to secure some very interesting sets of rights back to the producing community. It's a really good example of how the idea of creating a community can actually come together and usefully change legislation to the benefit of that community. The clearest example is that if I initiate a program idea and I sell it into a UK broadcaster through a British company, I am immediately entitled to a 90% equity stake in the lifetime value of the property I create. Over here, if I'm lucky and I pay gentlemen such as this good money to act as strong representation for me in a negotiation with the Discovery Channel or National Geographic, if I come away with 10 points, I'm going to be lucky. That's a big 80-point spread.
I have a question. And Jason, I know you're sort of wrapping up. You have to leave early for a conference call, so let's get this going. I guess the ultimate equalizer in our industry would be YouTube for a lot of reasons. Talk to me, each of you, your perspective on YouTube versus Viacom et al., where you see all that going. Will we ever find an end to that, or will that be an ongoing battle for many, many years to come?
I'll take that one first.
Finally
stumped the panel.
Yeah. It's funny enough, as somebody who's, you know, I'm an official partner of YouTube, and I wouldn't even begin to. I don't even know enough about the situation to imagine. I mean, I can just only agree with the rest of the people here that, like, however it shakes out is going to be really pivotal to figuring out how we all work here. You know, they're really dealing with a lot of big issues there, but I don't even feel the slightest bit qualified to imagine what it's doing.
It is a little hard for me because I have to make a disclosure, and that is my firm represents Premier League, so there's two entities. Well, there's more than two, but there's the Viacom case that everybody talks about, and then there's the Premier Football League case, which in some ways is, in many ways, is just as important. It's a class action, for example. My personal involvement with that one has been limited, but my firm represents Premier League, so anything I say is, I'm not going to go beyond the record, and you should understand what direction I'm coming from. And that is that Judge Stanton got it wrong. Judge Stanton essentially interpreted the Copyright Act to say that all an ISP has to do is take it down when they get a notice and they can put it up again and they don't have to worry about actual knowledge. So that's going to work out. I think one thing will change. You remember, Google today or YouTube today is not the entity over which the litigation started, right? They make all these warm and fuzzy noises, the press release 2 days ago. It's cool for a Google partner to be able to use Content ID, but you know that's not made available to non-Google partners.
Yeah, it's not a universal solution at all.
So it's a little rough. But what I think will change is the old Google approach, the old YouTube approach, and the Google book search approach, and it's not unique to them, is, you know, at the beginning you just grab everything you can get without asking questions. You know, take first, and if you can afford the lawyer's fees, worry about it later. And meanwhile, the price of a buyout or a takeover goes astronomically high. I think, I'm not smart enough to know the future, but I think that attitude is going to diminish, particularly among the big players. I think there is going to be a growing sense of responsibility among major entrants into the marketplace. Not everyone and not all the startups, but I think that will diminish. But I think generally, I mean, YouTube's doing deals. Google devised this settlement provision to try to take care of orphan books and try to give themselves some other advantages on the side, and you know, the judge is looking at that now. So I think some of the Wild West, which is counterintuitive because if anything, the technology is going to make the West wilder, but I think some of the Wild West copyright behavior will be likely to calm down a bit.
Interesting. Now, we promised the room that we would get you out of here at 45, which gives us 1 minute each for each of our panelists to make the world a better place. Should we start as we did at the beginning with the not that we aren't all creative people, but why don't we start with the two official creatives on our panel? Tim, you want to give us the 1 minute version of what would make all this better?
Oh my gosh, 1 minute version.
Aren't you short attention span, new media guy?
Yeah, exactly. I'm already thinking the next thing. I think the thing that, you know, it honestly hasn't been a huge problem, for our business. But I think the thing that would make things better would be, it seems like it has to be an industry solution, and it seems like we're already doing some of these things right now, which is that a lot of the major, and we're not that major, and we're a very, very tiny industry, the people that are making original web content. And so most of us that have any scale, we're all talking to each other right now, and we're sharing a lot of, we're trying to share a lot of best practices. And, I think that there's probably something in the lines of everybody sharing information and trying to figure out what are the best practices of this space. I think that so far it's been pretty, I think that a lot of people have realized that embracing a lot of the creativity of the commons or whatever you want to call it is actually good for business. I thought when we first started doing that we would be the only people doing it, but I very quickly saw most of the big media companies embrace it. Somebody raised the point of, well, will they keep embracing it when it puts them in a bad light? I think that's already happening, and in a lot of cases, most people have realized it's bad business to go after your consumers, and so I think that in a lot of cases it's been self-correcting so far, and I would just say to sort of try to solve the solutions by sharing best practices and by seeing what works.
Terrific. Jason, you have some social responsibility for us here.
I quick anecdote. 25 years of doing long-form documentary programming, about 500 hours altogether of output. I was trying to think when I have ever actually invoked fair use in all of that time. And I genuinely don't think I've ever specifically invoked it. I think on two occasions whilst doing documentaries, one for CNN and one when discovering the New York Times, there was a sense of implied fair use. That to me is tragic, because what it means is the fair use provisions are just so sort of epiphenomenal. They're so out there and fuzzy. They're so ultimately subject to that 35 page, which at 525 an hour, which is my law, and I bet you're a damn sight more than that, that's a really expensive memorandum to receive, and which provides you with no actionable value.
I can negotiate.
You like that? I like that. But that's actually kind of tragic, because what we just heard was that, well, people will make sure that they don't upset the people that they're talking about. Well, part of our job is to upset the people we make films about.
Good.
And I think in the absence of a robust and clearly defined fair use provision, a very, very sort of sad moment in the culture approaches where you're not going to be able to see the kind of robust critiques happening in the media that all of us deserve.
Okay. Well, please don't stop angering people. Stan McCoy, you are the person at the very forefront of needing to execute and administer these policies that are set by Congress and in some cases by other governments. What would make your life easier and make this issue more productive for everybody?
So my one thing is China. China, China, China. I'll repeat that for the full minute.
Well, and what will you do about China, please?
If you look at the most trafficked websites in the world, you'll find websites like Baidu, Sohu, Taobao in the very top of that category, because the internet marketplace is growing tremendously in China. Respect for copyright in China has a long way to go. According to the software industry, we lose something like $6 billion a year in U.S. software sales to China on an annual basis, just because Chinese companies aren't paying for it for copyright copyrighted software, and I'm sure that we're in the same boat on all kinds of copyrighted creative content in China. The rules governing a website like Baidu and its sort of deep linking activities are not clear, and every ounce of clarity we could add to the legal environment in China surrounding copyright would pay returns to U.S. creators in a big way.
Mm, terrific. All right, Mr. Longview Historical Perspective. What one thing will make this better?
Cool the rhetoric. I think I and others here have been involved in copyright disputes for years, and they've always been strongly felt on both sides, but I think in the last decade, the level of incivility and the level of mistrust among the community.
I think in the last decade, the level of incivility between and mistrust among the participants in the copyright debate has reached a level where it's very hard to find collaborative solutions. It's not that they're totally missing. I mean, to me, the poster child has always been DVD. I mean, you know, I've spent a lifetime, as Fritz has and others have, screaming at Gary Shapiro and his lawyers at the Electronic Industries Association. But the fact is, electronics companies, computer companies, and copyright owners got together in a room, guided by antitrust lawyers, I can assure you, and came out with the most successful consumer entertainment development that any of us can remember. So under the surface, there is real economic collaboration and cooperation going on. But the kind of policy level stuff, people have just gotten too darn loud and too darn antithetical to each other. And I think aside from some statutory changes I could think of that my colleagues on the copyright left would kill me for suggesting, I think that would be the one thing, just the level of discourse down to a manageable level.
Terrific. A big, big thank you to John Baumgartner from Proskauer Rose, right? To Jason Williams of JWM Productions, Tim Shea, Next New Networks, and from the United States government, Stan McCoy. thank you all so much. And the Copyrights Clearing Center for doing this. I present Bill Sobel, who will bless us on the way out the
door. Let's give Ellis a big hand.